All right, folks. Well, hello and welcome to another fan-freaking-tastic episode of RFRX. My name is Eric Wells, and I am the online programming director for Recovering From Religion. And with me is a fantastic and one of my favorite co-hosts, Sherry D'Souza. Sherry, welcome.
Hello. Welcome to welcoming me.
Sherry is a board member for Recovering From Religion, and she is also a support group leader for the virtual chapter and for the Sydney chapter and for the women's virtual chapter. So if you are attending either of those support groups, you'll get to see her and you know who she is. Without further ado, Sherry, would you please, please do the honors of introducing our amazing guest this evening?
We have the absolute honor of introducing Glenda Jordan, who will be speaking to us today. Now, Glenda is a professional model and artist with a decade-long career in Las Vegas as a dancer and entertainer. She was raised a Southern Baptist, but Glenda had her secular and feminist awakening in her early 20s. Now, when she's not performing or working in her studio, she's an incredible artist, by the way, she enjoys marathon video game sessions, traveling and spending time with her many pets. Glenda, welcome.
Hi, Sherry. Thank you so much for the introduction. I'm like blushing so much. I didn't need to put on any today because I'm just so tired. I wanted to do a really quick disclaimer. Speaking of the pets, I do have a recent rescue in my studio with me right now. So if she makes noise, snores, she snores really loudly. I apologize, but just so you know, she's thankfully sleeping right now, but wanted to get that through. Okay, I actually have a PowerPoint that I'm gonna start. So let me scroll down. Let me share screen and then keynote and then share and then press play. Okay, so I'm gonna go through the title slide first and then I'm gonna give a couple disclaimers and then we're gonna go through several definitions to get us all on a foundational page before we start this discussion. So as you can see from my title, we're going to be talking about objectification versus empowerment and recognizing the space of performance and rethinking the portrayal of femme bodies. And I need to move. I have to kind of like move this guy. It's in my way and my cursor is hidden. Uh-huh. I know it's kind of, oh my goodness. I'll figure it out. It's fine. It was just kind of like blocking my chat. It's fine.
We'll fix it in post.
Well, it's just like it's the Zoom menu bar over my. Yeah. It's fine. I know what my slides say. So, the first thing I want to say is that the feminist critique of media is pretty complicated, and there is no one true feminist opinion about what is right and wrong, and deciding what is right and wrong when critiquing subjective art and media forms like performance is just really complex, as you can imagine. This is simply a presentation on my personal views on the subject, coming from the perspective of an intersectional feminist who is also a performer. The lens in which I view this is impacted by my career, my privilege, my experiences. There are plenty of respected, intelligent, and dedicated intersectional feminists who might disagree with some of my viewpoints on the subject. So I just wanted to give that clarification.
Glenda?
Yes.
I have a question right off the bat.
Yes, please.
You've mentioned this a few times already. Intersectional feminist.
Yes. Please, this is my favorite
what's
question.
That?
So, yes, I would love the opportunity to explain what is intersectional feminism. So most people have heard the term feminism within this school of thought, within this philosophy about gender. There are different categories. There's radical feminism, which I disagree with. There is raunch feminism. I'm an intersectional feminist. So intersectional feminism. Intersectionality is an analytical framework for understanding how aspects of a person's social and political identities combine to create different modes of discrimination and privilege. This term was coined by this really incredible activist. I highly recommend you go. I don't have any links to her stuff, but her name is Kimberly Crenshaw. She coined this term in 1989. And intersectionality identifies multiple factors of advantage and disadvantage. So for examples of those factors, gender, race, class, religious upbringing, body weight, like education, these ability, where your sexuality, these are all intersecting and overlapping social identities that may be both empowering and oppressing. For example, I'm white. We live in kind of a white supremacist culture in the United States, so that benefits me. I'm more likely to be hired for a job. I'm more likely to be accepted for certain things. I'm also a woman. That's a disadvantage for me. So if you're a white disabled person, you have that privilege, but then you have a disadvantage. So I know some people don't like labels, and I appreciate that perspective, and that's your choice if you choose to not identify with those. But when in the conversation with intersectional feminism, that's why we use those terms, because it identifies struggles and privileges that a single person might have. Does that explain that? Answer your question?
Well, yeah. So it's looking at it not through just one single lens, mm-hmm. but you're looking at it from multiple points mm-hmm. of view mm-hmm. or multiple lenses. Mm-hmm. And so it gives you a more nuanced.
Yes, I was about to say, it's almost like nuance.
Yeah.
When speaking about complicated subjects might be important.
Funny that, yeah.
What an idea. What a concept.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. I understand that now. Mm-hmm.
Is this more of like this? I'm so sorry.
No worries.
I'm a little slow. So intersectional feminism, this kind of cover the issues that women struggle with in all different, whether they're white, black, trans, straight, gay,
right.
Is it okay?
That's kind of a good angle to come at it. It's more identifying my perspective on, I'm an intersectional feminist. And so I believe in these analytical frameworks. I believe in these privileges and disadvantages. For example, radical feminists are trans exclusionary. I am not a trans exclusionary person. So that's an entire subset of feminism. And I recommend if you ever like doing like the Wikipedia deep dive binges, which I love doing, it's one of my hobbies, just look up the feminism portal on Wikipedia and you can read forever and ever. It's very dry, but all the different subsets of feminism. So intersectional feminism is kind of the term to describe kind of contemporary leftist feminism. So radical feminists are also, not only are they trans exclusionary, a lot of them they're called TERFs or SWERFs, trans exclusionary radical feminist, or SWERF, sex work exclusionary radical feminist. Oh. I'm not exclusionary of sex work. I don't reject sex work as a form of occupation.
Right.
Got it. I know. I'm trying to keep this
awesome.
Like,
no, this is awesome. Yeah. So the term intersectional mm-hmm. feminism is like super all encompassing and it's not exclusionary is what I'm hearing.
Yes. And it's like it would be, it helps describe the first wave of feminism, as it were, in the early 21st or 20th century or whatever, of women deserve the right to vote, votes for women. That wasn't exactly accurate, was it? Because it wasn't votes for women, it was just votes for white women.
Oh, so got it.
That's why, like, that's, or if I say women are paid less than men, yes, that's true, but black women and women of color are paid even less than white women. So it's kind of not, it's not accurate enough. You have to tie in those intersectional elements in order to create more understanding.
Yeah. So it's non-judgmental.
Yes, it's non-judgmental. It's
holistic. It's taking into account all of the many different contributing factors.
Correct.
Or conditions. Yeah, that's fantastic. I actually really appreciated that, the description of what it wasn't as well.
Right. I am a performer. I'm not a trans performer. I have modeled with trans models and they have an entirely separate world of difficulties that I don't have to deal with. That's an example of just like different intersecting identities. I hope that I've explained this enough. I wasn't expecting to like ramble on with this definition.
No, but I actually found that very helpful in sort of informing my view, mm-hmm. and also identifying that I really like the idea of this intersectional feminism. I don't like this idea at all, actually.
The phrase is, my feminism shall be intersectional or it shall be bullshit.
I like that.
Intersectional feminism, call it. Yeah, and sorry, waiter, I didn't order the swarf and turf. That's a feminist joke, right?
That's a good one. I like it. I only just got it now. I wouldn't have got it 5 minutes ago, but hey.
Didn't worry the story. Yeah, so now you'll be, there's a whole world of humor that you'll be able to have, like, really niche feminist humor. Okay.
So, does this come with a side of J.K. Rowling? Anyway,
that's
I'm
an
sorry.
Entirely separate talk. Good Lord. Okay, so... onto my next slide. Oh wait, am I not on my thing? Next slide. Oh, am I just okay? There we go. Here's my content warning for the talk. I'm going to be discussing sexism and misogyny, sexual harassment and rape culture, racism, ableism, body shaming, nudity, everything that's kind of encompassing on that. So just that we're all on the same page of the things I'm going to be discussing. Okay. So I really do need to move this bar. It's in my way. Hold on. The problem
is fine.
Yes, I moved it. Yay me. Okay. And because your videos are hiding the top bar. So like I have no title thing, but I know what it says. We're going to go through some basic definitions first. So as I said, basic definitions so that we're all on the same page. What is objectification? So female, this is just snatched from the internet unceremoniously. Female sexual objectification involves a woman being viewed primarily as an object of sexual desire rather than as a whole person. So something that I want to clarify right now is that objectification can be non-sexual, and we objectify working class folks all day, every day. If anyone has worked in retail or the service industry, we understand people do not view them as human beings. They treat them as inhuman, as little robot cogs in a machine. And so objectification can be non-sexual. I'm going to be focusing on female sexual objectification from the lens of a performer, but I just wanted to clarify that there's a very broad, as with other feminism, this topic is so broad and there is so much to learn about sexism, misogyny, the male gaze, raunch culture, etc. So just to clarify, female sexual objectification is going to be my focus here, but it can happen in a non-sexual way. Right. And men can be objectified, workers can be objectified. This little niche section that I'm, because this is my expertise that I'm going to be focusing on.
Right.
Cool. Are we good on objectification? Sort of. I mean, I'm going to get into it. We're good on this definition.
So like a non-sexual objectification might be like me expecting my wife to make do the dishes and make dinner all the time, even if it's not even sexual or anything like that.
I appreciate where you're coming from. That is actually an entire separate conversation about the division of labor with gender roles. And I would love to talk about that too. But that, yeah, in a way, yes. If you aren't recognizing the person as a whole person and just this like object to either be sexual desire for you or do tasks for you, it would be like dehumanizing housekeeping staff. Like, you don't, they're just there to pick up after you, and like not recognizing them as a person who has rights and a whole identity and a whole life and a whole world to themselves that doesn't revolve around you. So that's why I do the bring up the working class, because we have a very much a customer is always right culture, at least here in America under capitalism. And the way that service industry workers and retail workers in general are objectified and dehumanized is fucking astounding. Why are my coupon expired? Why aren't you taking it?
Right.
That type of thing. So now we're going to go another definition. Let me, once again, why aren't you letting me click? There we go. Sorry. So what is empowerment? This is another definition just snatched from the internet. The process of becoming stronger and more confident, especially in controlling one's life and claiming one's rights. Is that vague enough for you?
I don't mind the description, though. While it is vague, I agree.
It is extremely vague. It's vague even in the definition. So There is, so this, the term empowerment kind of became this ubiquitous term in like the 90s, and it got slapped on everything marketed towards women, including things that were the exact opposite of empowering. And an example of this is multi-level marketing and pyramid schemes, multi-level MLMs. So like Herbalife, doTERRA, Young Living Oils, LuLaRoe, every single one, right. Yeah. They're global. They're not just in America. They're global. They, if you go to their websites, first, they almost exclusively target women, and they, I swear, every single one of them uses the term empowerment to describe their business model. When it is the exact opposite. It's exploitative and predatory towards women. So that's an example of like, it's a vague term. It gets slapped on everything. What does it mean? What does it mean to be empowered? And of course, it's confusing because I'm seeing times where it's used and it's the exact opposite of that. Okay. I think we get, yes. All right. So these are four questions that I think can apply to pretty much any conversation about social justice, but for the purpose of this talk, I want, as we get into this, I want you to keep these four questions in mind. So who has the power? Who controls the space? Who has the choice? And what is the impact? So it's kind of like a little litmus test to get through on, is this objectifying or is it empowering? And these are some good questions, and sunlight's about to pierce through my eyeballs, and I'm not gonna bother with my blinds right now. So pardon me for that. So these four questions, are we good on the questions?
Yes.
Yay. Yeah. Okay, more definitions. What is go-go dancing? Because it's probably most people don't know. Of course they don't know. Why would you know? It's a very, very, very niche, specific, unique, small career. So
I think of Austin Powers when I think of go-go dancing.
With the white platform boots.
Yeah. Yeah. In a cage.
That's how it started. Yes, that's how it started. And, okay. You know, there's kind of like varying of when was the first go-go dancer actually a thing? It's like, well, what do you describe it? Is it public performance of women dancing in a space? Because that's been going on since time immemorial. Is it in a nightclub? When would you describe a nightclub being created? Et cetera, et cetera. So go-go dancing is female performance. It can be done by men, but just to clarify that that's almost exclusively in a gay nightclub setting. Not always. Sometimes we perform next to men, but not. It's almost always women. We're in nightclubs, entertainment venues, nightlife areas, and we wear elaborate costumes or simple costumes, and I dance on stages either freestyle or sometimes it's choreographed. I suck at choreography, so I pretty much just do freestyle go-go dancing. These three photos, and I'm going to describe them real quick for our callers who are listening in. We have three photos. I'm in all three. The bottom left has four women in an interior space wearing really elaborate macrame outfits in gold bikinis. The top photo, I am in a silver bodysuit with knee-high pointed boots overlooking the Las Vegas Strip. And in the right, I am wearing an LED sexualized airline outfit. I don't really know what the outfit was for this. The only thing I didn't like about it is that collar gave me like rashes on my neck, which that was the only thing I didn't like about that outfit. Otherwise, it was very fun.
So, it doesn't look like it was really heavy because it looks light.
Yes, some of these, another thing to recognize with some of these outfits is they can get very, very, very elaborate. Here are some more pictures of outfits, and they can be very fun, but extremely difficult to perform in. I just had a show last week where I was doing circus performance with a hula hoop. Some people have seen it, and I had two massive battery packs the size of a book strapped on my back to light up the LED harness. And I was wearing these like wedges with lights inside of it. And then I had this like crazy hat on that I had to perform around, and it was very complicated. But these are an example of different outfits that performers can wear throughout. This is like music festival scene. So like I said, it's almost always done by women. It's in a performance setting. I'm actually friends with the girl in the bottom right with the LED glasses. She designs and makes these costumes. So sometimes we make them ourselves. Sometimes the venue makes them. I really am a big fan of the animal heads. I think those are cool.
Yeah, those are kind of cool too. Aren't I like the cool? animal heads. Yeah.
Right. So it's just a form of entertainment. It's a form of like female dancing entertainment. If you think of like the Rockettes or something like that, it's just kind of similar. Okay, now next one. All right, So I put this photo on here, and to describe the photo real quick, we have five photos of various cheerleaders on a football field in the middle of doing a performance. And the text on each one of those photos says, fine, 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 fine. And then on the bottom right, we have J-Lo when she was doing her Super Bowl performance, and it says gasp with all caps, because especially for non-Americans, if you aren't aware, the NFL stands for the National Football League, correct? It is league and not another word. I don't sports ball. I just do critique of sports ball. So this was during the Super Bowl a couple years ago, and it was, if you were involved in social media at all or had any SJW friend to talk about it, you probably heard discussions about the concept of objectification versus empowerment when it came to this. And a good point that was brought up is, why is the performance that J-Lo and Shakira did considered too sexual and objectifying, when all these cheerleaders, this was seen as all American and fine up to this point? Where's the line, and what's the difference in what's good and what's wrong? I wanted to ask you a question real quick on when we had those four questions on who has the control, who has the choice, who controls the space, whatever. A form of control is financial control, and financial freedom for women is very important. And I want to ask you, how much do you think NFL cheerleaders get paid a game?
Oh.
Keep in mind, the NFL has more money than you could shake a stick at. Billions of dollars.
That's a very hard question for me to answer. I mean, I barely have any idea on what Australian cheerleaders get per game. Oh, okay. This is completely ignorant, and I am from Australia, so I'm gonna poke a stick out there and go $500 a game.
That would be great. It averages out to be about $50 a game.
What?
$50 for these cheerleaders?
If you're really lucky, you'll get $150 a game.
Like tips? Like what?
No, that's their financial compensation for their performance.
They got so much money. This is ridiculous.
They have more money than God, than the Pope. Well, probably not. Who has more money, the NFL or the Catholic Church? But it's kind of a bunch of bullshit, isn't it?
They have to have jobs to support them then.
Yes, they do.
Can't make a career on that.
Yes, they do. So they have to work two jobs. And keep in mind, it's not just like they show up to the football
and train and rehearse. And they leave. Yeah.
It's choreographed, professional, trained athletes that are doing these performances. They also, when this Super Bowl thing came out, there were these kind of exposés on like the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders are super famous, who had to do topless photo shoots in presence of the team without really being compensated for it. Ask me if I ever get my tits out for free.
I know I don't.
But the whole, I mean, I ask it crudely in that way, but if you think about those four questions on who has the control, who has the space, and who has the power, these cheerleaders are exploited and they deserve more money.
Well, can I also just, these women would have to train hard, keeping those bodies in shape and then having to do all the rehearsing, they'd be working in some cases probably as hard as guys are.
Mm-hmm. So if, you know, the media, society, and I know I sound cringy when I use that term, have this reaction for this Super Bowl of like, this is too sexualized and wrong, and this is objectifying women with what Shakira and J-Lo are doing. And I actually, that was another thing, is that they had pole dancers for that performance. I happen to be good friends with one of the pole dancers, and she and I have performed together in Vegas for years, Denisha Crowder, love you, babe, she's great. She was one of the performers, and she got paid infinitely more than any of these cheerleaders to do this performance. So I'm hoping this talk isn't going too long, because I'm taking a really long time on these slides.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry.
With the space and the power, it seems like just with this NFL, the one Super Bowl game, like there were two different spaces from what I'm hearing. There was one where the game itself that was kind of owned by the NFL and the cheerleaders were in that space, and they're getting $50 a game. And then the completely other space was the halftime show and the dancers there who were doing just as much work if not maybe a little less than the cheerleaders were getting paid scads more than that.
Yes, lots more money.
That doesn't seem to be equal.
No, it does not. And it's almost like instead of just deciding whether or not something is objectifying or empowering based on observation, you might have to delve a little deeper and ask the women themselves.
Wait a minute.
I mean, it's like when I first learned that's how much they get paid a game. I mean, I was absolutely shocked too. I just, for reference, like this gig I had last Wednesday, I got about $400 to do 5 hours worth of specialized performance. When I do atmosphere modeling, which is just you stand around and be attractive, it's like 85 an hour can be. So the fact that those are those rates, and yet this industry that has more money, I can't express how much money these people have. And players, football players who are, not that they don't deserve to get paid, football players on the side getting paid millions of dollars to sit there. I digress. We're continuing on.
Okay. I got paid $200 for 4 hours to play Santa for dogs. And these amazing women are getting paid $50 for way more work than what I did. That's ridiculous.
It's pretty enraging and infuriating. And the solution is not like they shouldn't be cheerleaders. The solution is they should get paid more money.
Right. Right.
It's fine to have cheerleaders.
What is the incentive there for them?
Because it's the same way that I feel like, and I'm about to talk shit about some interior go-go stuff, but like the go-go dancers at EDC do not get paid a lot of money. EDC is one of the largest electronic festivals in the world. It's kind of like, because then you're famous, like I'm a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader. It's a very coveted position. The auditions are incredibly intense and insane, like to be there and be part of it. And you get to travel, you do have these perks, there are benefits that come from it. And because they want to do it, I want to be a dancer. It's not, you know, they're passionate about performing and they want to be a performer. So it's really the cheerleaders above all else, it's truly a labor of love because they just are not compensated for what they're doing, but they're passionate about the job.
So there's like, hey, Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, you get to do this for the exposure. I'm sure as an artist, you love doing things for the exposure. And that exposure helps pay the rent and everything like that too.
I go straight to my mortgage company and pay my mortgage with my exposure bucks.
Wow.
So moving on to how religion ties into this is that the Abrahamic and patriarchal faiths frame female sexuality and portrayal of our bodies as sinful. And then I'm gonna pop in a couple of tropes to deconstruct that stem from religion. The first trope is Jezebel. I'm not gonna get too into this because it's really not my place as a white person to go into exactly how this affects the Black community, but I highly recommend you researching this and listening to some Black activists about exactly the impact that Jezebel has had, especially during in times of enslavement in our country. It's trigger warning, it's very, very, very gross and violent. Eve, women as the original betrayers and manipulators. So whether or not you were brought up in religious cultures, and this is all kind of from a Western perspective, okay? I just want another thing I want to make clear, like I'm an American, I grew up here, this is kind of like my Western perspective, Christian heritage background.
Dean Smith right there, we got on the right.
Yeah.
I think Daryl needs to hear
so. I think, yeah, we got just had to interject for crying out loud.
So Eve, I think a lot of us who came from Christianity kind of understand the concept of when Eve was presented as this, like, that she's the reason that everything is the way it is. Like, she caused the fall of man. And from that stemmed this trope of women having these like feminine wiles and manipulating and seducing men. How many mythological tropes do we have specifically about female creatures that exist to seduce men? You have the succubus, the
sirens.
Yes, all of those things. And how many terms, sexual terms that are denigrative towards women. So, and then the Virgin Mary is like virginity and chasteness being the most respected position of a woman. You know, women were kind of framed, if you survived purity culture, which I did myself, I always like to pull this up. You know, I do. I have my purity culture pledge card from middle school. So the onus is on women to control whether or not we arouse men. And when women do arouse men, it's seen as our fault. And so that persists today on whether or not you're in a religious space or not, or you're in a secular place. We see the intentional arousal, like the intentional triggering of arousal from women, as kind of bad. If you kind of understand what I'm like picking up, like mm-hmm. when women are, if that's something they're intentionally doing, we see that as immoral. It's like, I'm making you desire me on purpose.
Yeah, we've heard that a lot here in RFRX as well, like how women have shared how they felt they were made to feel guilty when some boy got aroused around them, and like just because of what they wear, even right. though they enjoyed wearing it, they felt good in it.
Right.
If yeah.
And so the idea of a woman choosing a profession where it is kind of the intent of the profession on purpose to create desire and arousal is like extra demonized, right? And then that's when we're hearing, oh, but you know, it's objectifying. We're going to get into it. Okay. So I'm going to start with some Paleolithic art history for you. I joke, but I'm serious. So we're going to talk about the portrayal of female bodies in art and entertainment and what is good and bad. And another clarification here, I'm not talking about the technical prowess of the pieces themselves when I use the terms good and bad. Like, they're clearly all aesthetically skilled creations. I'm not saying it's painted poorly. So to describe the images real quick, we have three works of art. On the far left, we have Venus of Willendorf. It's a stone carved figure of a woman. She doesn't have any discernible facial features, but she has curled ringlets. She has very large breasts, a large waist and a navel. And it's kind of hard to see in the photo, but there was a defined vulva carved on this little sculpture. So, and then you have The Birth of Venus. This was by Sandra Botticelli. It's an oil painting. It's a huge oil painting. You have a thin, hairless, naked white woman. And anytime I say hairless, I mean anything but body hair. So, thin, hairless, naked white woman standing in a seashell. There are angels on one side blowing magic air onto her, and then a lady in waiting coming with a piece of cloth to cover her on the other side. You have the Bath of Psyche. Yes, the Bath of Psyche. Once again, my thing is covering my little text there. We have a thin, naked, hairless white woman standing in what is a bath, narcissistically looking down on herself. And I use the word narcissistically because that is how it's described in art critique format. So her staring at herself narcissistically, as is described. Okay. So we're going to talk about the female nude in art, and when was it considered good and when was it considered bad? When was it considered the pinnacle of artistic achievement or inappropriate smut? And I know it may seem like I'm going out of far left field. Like, what does this have to do with cheerleading? You're going to have to hang in there with me because I promise it's all going to come around. Okay. NFL cheerleaders. Keep that. So this is the source. This was painted by Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres in 1856. It's oil on canvas. It's a pretty life-size painting. And Eric, I want to ask you, Eric and Sherry, I'm going to ask you, was this painting, do you believe this was considered, and the audience can participate in the chat, was this painting considered immoral or moral, good or bad?
In 1856?
Mm-hmm. I was just about to ask the same question then.
And it's a thin, hairless, naked white woman, just so everyone knows. Not that I have to clarify this anymore. Thin, naked, hairless, white woman. She's gazing just off to the screen. She's not a screen. She's not looking directly at us as a viewer. She's gazing just off, and she's holding a terracotta vessel, pouring out water, and she has no visible labia or any sort of genitals painted.
I'm kind of thinking this was a moral, viewed moral painting, yes, at the time.
It was scandalous. People saw and said, this is inappropriate.
Really?
What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, that was the same time that you had Botticelli and Leighton, and they did a lot of nudist paintings at the time.
Right. I'm going to say naked women.
Yeah. I'm going to say that it wasn't considered immoral. It was considered art.
Right. So at the time that this was created, this was considered the best representation of the female nude in art. It was described as like there was nothing to top this. This is the pinnacle of artistic achievement of representation of the female form in art. The model was actually a 16-year-old child who was the daughter of a colleague of Aang. We don't know too much about her. I tried to do a little more research, but unfortunately it was under quite a heavy academic paywall. Surprise, surprise. But the only other thing I'm going to tell you about this painting is, and we're going to come back to it, but I'm going to leave you with a quote about this painting. The Irish novelist George Moore said of this painting, "What care I that the virtue of some 16-year-old maid was the price for Aang's The Source? That the model died of drink and disease in the hospital is nothing when compared with the essential that we should have The Source, that exquisite dream of innocence."
Oh, boy.
That's horrible.
Okay, we're going to get back to it. It's fucking vile.
That makes me feel gross. Yeah.
Makes you feel gross. But yeah. So on the outside, we saw it's like, it's awesome, without caring to delve a little deeper into what, remember what that fourth question was?
Yeah, what's the impact?
Mm-hmm. Mm. On to the next painting. Okay, this is the Venus of Urbino. This was done by Titian in 1534. It's oil on canvas. Good or bad, yay or nay, you gotta answer.
The impact, that was, okay. Oh man, it's coming together. 1534? Yes, this was moral. I'm saying this is moral. This was.
Yeah, they liked it.
Sure, yeah, I liked it.
For the sake of it, I'm going to go opposite to you, Eric, and say no. They were more religious fundamentalist in 1534 and went, "Eh, scandal."
So, just to describe the painting real quick, we have, you already know what I'm going to say: thin, naked, hairless white woman laying on a sumptuous bed. She's in kind of a Renaissance interior. She's holding some flowers in one of her hands. Her left arm is curled over her body, covering her genitals with her fingertips curled towards her crotch. And then there's a dog sleeping on the end of the bed, and there's some ladies in waiting in the background. So I'm just gonna leave you with a quote, another quote. About this.
I mean,
painting.
She probably had an itch. They didn't bathe very often back then. So I'm just kind of like, hey, I got an itch and the pain is kind of just.
Okay. I'm never going to see the painting the same way again. Like, oh my goodness. Okay. All right. I'm going to leave you with a quote. "You enter and proceed to that most visited little gallery in the world. And there, against the wall, without obstructing rag or leaf, you may look your fill upon the foulest, the vilest, the obscenest picture the world possesses, Titian's Venus. It isn't that she is naked and stretched out on a bed. No, it is the attitude of one of her arms and hand. If I ventured to describe that attitude, there would be a fine howl. But there the Venus lies for anybody to gloat over that wants to. There are pictures of nude women which suggest no impure thought. I am well aware of that. I am not railing against such. What I am trying to emphasize is the fact that Titian's Venus is very far from being one of that sort." And would you like to know who said that?
Who said that?
Mark
My mom.
Twain.
Mark Twain said that?
I know, it's nuts.
I'm crushed.
Right. So that was generally the attitude at the time of people seeing this as like, oh, she's looking a little like she's enjoying herself there. This is a little
we can't have that.
She's looking at us, but she's got her head turned. She's almost, it looks like she's touching her naughty bits, which is, as we know, because Jesus said so, it makes baby Jesus cry to touch her naughty bits.
Oh my goodness.
So
if it was bad, I would expect the dog to also be licking herself or himself.
So wow. One more painting to cover, and then we're gonna kind of like go back. Okay, this is to describe the painting. Now, for once, I'm not gonna use the term hairless, because we have a thin, naked white woman who's laying on a bed. Now, it's hard to see in this in the original painting, or in this picture, in the original painting, which I've had the honor and privilege of seeing in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. It's huge. You can kind of tell here. Do you see that there's a little suggestion of body hair in her armpit?
Yeah.
A little bit
yeah,
of a suggestion? Okay. Radical to convey that women have body hair. So this is Manet's Olympia. So once again, to describe, we have a thin, naked white woman lounging on a bed. She's laying on this embroidered shawl. She has a bracelet. She's got one slipper off her foot and one slipper on. She has a black choker on her neck, earrings on, and an orchid in her hair. A lady in waiting is delivering a bouquet of flowers from an admirer. And then there's a black hat on the end of the bed. So was this painting considered good or bad?
Good.
Good? This is impressionist era art.
That's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. The cat
going with good.
It looks bad. It looks
so it's the cat that's the problem.
Have you ever seen a cat? Yeah, sure.
I think that this is immoral because the cat is kind of looking scared. I don't know.
So this painting was considered so scandalous and inappropriate that it was actually banned from being displayed in a lot of different places. On her hand, the foreshortening, which means painting something at an angle, that was praised for being, okay, well, I'll give it to him. That's technically skilled. I will give him that. But there was such a public outcry because here, Manet has painted a sex worker.
But she doesn't have an itch like the other one does at all. I mean, her hand is clearly...
not the same way.
No. So, but that's just because this is a sex worker?
Oh, yeah. It was, well, and you have to kind of understand that up until then, the depiction, you were allowed to paint naked women and enjoy them as long as they were goddess muse figures. But the second it kind of is suggested that they have their own sexuality, or importantly, that they chose their nudeness, then that's when we see this as being inappropriate and scandalous and bad. And you would think that centuries and centuries on, we would have gotten a little better about it, but we haven't. That's why I'm here giving this talk. But so another piece of information that's very important that I want to give you about this painting. The model here, her name is Victorine Meurent. She was a famous model for the Impressionists. She didn't just work for Manet. She modeled for several different Impressionists. She was also an incredible artist herself. She had her own paintings that were curated in shows. She was an incredibly successful woman and was living her best life. So just to recap, this was considered the best painting ever, even though it was a child who was used for the painting, who had serious consequences that happened to her after this painting was created, but we still like, oh, but it's great, we love it. This one, because it's more of her own sexuality, even though the model herself, the impact was she lived her best life, we saw this as being bad and immoral.
Yeah.
Are you picking up what I'm putting down?
Yeah.
I can't tell the difference between these.
Right, okay, that's the other thing of like, you know, to our contemporary eyes, if you go into an art museum and you see nude paintings, they're everywhere, right? It's like, yeah, gilded frame, nudes in art, it's all the same. But it really wasn't at the time, like the context of these paintings, the historicity of this really does matter on how we perceive them at the time and what the impact was for how people saw it. There was a lot of, we spoke a lot more with symbolism back then. Like all of the things in this painting symbolized something, which is how people knew it was a sex worker that he was portraying. So I think I'm still good on my notes. All right, so that, yeah, this history has a narrative of what is good and bad with the portrayal of women's bodies. And when these images suggested that women chose their nudeness or had their own sexuality, that's when they were deemed immoral and wrong. And only when they were mythical goddess figures was it deemed kind of okay. And this judgment persists today on what we consider ethical and unethical. So to describe the image in this slide, there is a marble sculpture of a woman. She's nude and her arms are raised above her head, and someone has photoshopped a cell phone into her hand to make it look like she's taking a selfie. This is one of my favorite quotes of all time. This is from John Berger, his book Ways of Seeing, which is a great book. "You painted a naked woman because you enjoyed looking at her, put a mirror in her hand, and called the painting vanity, thus morally condemning the woman whose nakedness you had depicted for your own pleasure." Do you remember this painting, the back of Psyche? I was like, she's narcissistically looking at herself. You were the one who painted her!
Oh, because she's looking at her reflection.
Right. And it's just, and we saw that as like, oh, narcissistic women looking at herself. It's like, you were the one who painted her. You. Like, you wanted to look at a naked woman. So you put her there so you look at her, and then you call her narcissistic?
Glenda.
Yes.
I just had an epiphany.
Yes.
So Olympia had the power because she chose her work, chose how she was going to live her life. She controlled her own space. She had her own choice and she used it.
Right.
And yet the impact was terrible because it was so just scandalous. Mm-hmm. And yet when you look at the source, there's no way a 16-year-old had power. She wasn't controlling her own space. She didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And yet the impact was
that they loved it.
That's marvelous. This is just wonderful. That smacks to me of misogynistic religion being the underpinning.
It all comes together. Yes.
And, oh, sorry if I jumped ahead there.
No, that's yes.
It suddenly all clicked that's the problem here.
And it, once again, it's almost like you have to actually get more context about the bodies you're seeing at the time. I'm like, is this objectifying or is it empowering? I need more information. I got to know more. Right. So, and then the John Berger quote. Okay, so getting into another reason why people have such difficulty with like, oh, I see this is objectifying, but this is fine. I found over my career that people could walk past Victoria's Secret stores and be perfectly fine with seeing 8-foot abs of this, but then they would see me on stage and clutch their pearls because it was just so scandalous. And and I remember trying to like deconstruct this at the time, like why do people have this response? It's like they can walk past the store, they can have bikini ads for JCPenney on their kitchen counter in front of their kids, and that's perfectly fine. But then when it comes to performance like this, it's just seen as like, well, that's too sexy, or it's she's objectifying herself and degrading herself and et cetera. But for these models, it's not like, and then trying to think about, okay, well, where do you draw the line with that's empowering for women and that's fine for women to be in that position and that's not? Like, are the Rockettes, these professional trained performers, is that okay or is it not okay? Cheerleaders, yay or nay? Ballet dancers, yay or nay? Go-go dancers, like, and then realizing like, oh, actually, I find that a lot of our perceptions on what we consider good and bad kind of has a lot to do with what is for us too sexual or non-sexual, because we have such a puritanical anti-female sexuality culture. So forgive me if this is, we're going to get into something and it's going to sound extremely patronizing and pandering, but just not pandering, patronizing, but hang in there with me because I'm going to have a point. So another reason why people struggle with this is because they struggle with being able to recognize what is the space of performance and when is acceptable for women to have their bodies exposed, when is it okay, and how can you tell when a woman is performing? And I know that seems obvious, but it's not for many people. They live their life expecting women to perform for them, and I'll get into that. So, for example, a sidewalk is not a goddamn stage for women. It's not a performance stage. And I have a picture of a sidewalk. I also have a picture of an office, which is still not a stage.
Oh, so is this going back to like the trope of a woman walks by a group of construction workers and they're expecting her to perform or something like that?
Yes and no. I'm going to get into it. So a gym is surprisingly also not a burlesque theater for you. So recognizing the space of performance is really important, because the problem is that regardless of whether or not she is on stage, the sun came through. I'm just gonna, okay, because like melting my eyes. Okay, regardless of whether or not she is on stage, we do selectively sexualize and desexualize women without their consent based on a variety of those intersectional factors, right? Like based on her age, her body type, her ethnicity, what she's wearing, we decide like, oh, okay, well, you're being sexy for me or you're not being sexy for me. So, and I, once again, bear with me. So one of the most important elements of contemporary feminism is the concept of choice. and adhering to patriarchal beauty standards is a choice that we generally agree should be left up to the individual, like body hair removal. However, we understand that this decision is not made in a vacuum, and choosing, and I'm using air quotes, choosing to remove body hair in a society where female body hair is so forbidden that advertisements depict shaving already hairless bodies. And to describe the pictures, we have four different pictures of women shaving their armpits and their legs, and it could not be smoother. It is so smooth you could ice skate on it. There is not a suggestion of hair. And think about, when was the last time have you ever seen an advertisement to depict a razor doing the job it's supposed to do, which is actually removing body hair?
I had never, ever considered this before. I mean, I shaved for this and all sorts of stuff came out when I washed it out. And right. I don't see that in these ads.
Right. And you, and when you move throughout the world and throughout your little, your microcosm of culture, don't you think you would probably notice if a woman raised her arms and she had very obvious armpit hair?
Of course. Yeah.
Yes. It's seen as like it, to me, the body hair question, as it were, is kind of a litmus test for feminism on how progressive is the society, because it affects nobody. It hurts nobody. It's none of your motherfucking business whether or not somebody has body hair. And yet we are so sanitized with the women having it. And the reason I bring this up is because you may not think that you ask women to perform for you, but if you believe that a woman should remove her body hair, that is objectification, because you are denying part of her humanity. Our humanity, being humans, is having body hair, and demanding that we quite literally shave that down for you, for your visual pleasure, is dehumanizing and objectifying, because that's denying the base nature of our being, our humanity. And it's amazing how far we have to go with that. Like, you just ask people on the street, like, what do you think about a woman with body hair? And it's just incredible. It's like, it's gross. It's, we are so far from reaching this level where women can freely, like, yeah, I choose to grow out my armpit hair. I choose, even when I have the ability to grow it out, sometimes I just choose to shave it because I would rather shave it than deal with the response if I'm moving through the world, if I'm in between gigs. I really get tired of the looks that you get when you have excessive body hair on yourself as a woman. It's also really, this standard makes life even harder for women with PCOS, trans women, non-binary people, because having the standard of femininity means hairlessness.
PCOS?
Polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Yes, polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's a, it's genetic, isn't it? I think it's genetic. It's not.
It's part of the condition causes excessive hair growth, because it's there's a hormonal component to it. So my sister actually has PCOS, so I know it rather well.
All right, thank you for describing that, Sherry. Yeah, because I totally forgot to, like, that's a definition that some people might not know, PCOS. Yeah. And it means, it's the whole, like, when a bearded woman, a lot of times they have, it's because they have PCOS, and it you know, women can grow enough facial hair to have a beard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... well, it's super, super, super cool. So,
but Glenda, you've made me think of something, and that's that I used to complain about this, even as a Jehovah's Witness, that women have to jump through all of these hoops as far as hair is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've got to make sure that your upper lip is clear. Yes, your underarms. Yes, your legs. And, oh, my God, it's just so much fucking maintenance.
Right, that, and I remember having this experience when I was deconstructing religion. Okay, all right, I'm listening to you, church. All right, God created human beings. Yes, perfect, exactly designed the way he wanted us to be designed. We are perfect in his image. Yes, okay, so then why do I need to remove my body hair then? Why aren't you, as church leaders, on the forefront of saying, like, you absolutely don't have to do this. God made you perfect the way you are. And it's, even if you were really progressive, it's fine if you want to remove it, but you don't have to, because this is, God made you beautiful this way. And yet, fucking religious people are the most conservative with this and have, like, the biggest sticks up their asses about women having body hair. Like, It's
so Glenda, I totally agree. I used to have it, I used to think that obviously either it was imperfection that women had so much hair. Right?
Yes.
And that when we go into the new system, then we would have the perfection of not having all of this hair that we had to remove. Right. And it's just so stupid.
And think about art history since we started creating, yeah. Because before the most of society was literate, our only way to convey to people history of the Bible, Bible stories, was through paintings. And if you look at paintings, even when we first started making art of women, did we paint them with body hair? No. And that's fucked up. And art history and artists have a lot to, like, I mean, I'm not speaking for past artists, but like a lot to answer for with perpetuating this idea that like, this is just what the beautiful woman looks like. Yeah. No body hair, because that's gross. We want her as childlike as possible.
Yeah,
which is another level.
Really.
Yeah. Right. Right. So and to describe the images here, it's two photos of me. The one on the left, I'm wearing a rainbow monokini and I've got spray tan and glitter and outfit. And the other one, wearing a gold lamé bikini with that macrame. And these were both go-go performances. The point of this talk, I don't want you to see that what I'm doing here is a feminist act. Sometimes there's this kind of girl power response. I'm like, oh yeah, like that's awesome. You're empowering women. And it's like, I don't want you to see that this is necessarily like a feminist thing, because I am adhering to patriarchal standards of beauty by participating in this. Like I'm shaving, I'm waxing, I'm getting my nails, like all these things. But it's in the performance space, this is a fantasy. It's not real. And I know that seems like a vague term to describe, it's not real, but fantasy is about play and desire and performance. And it's okay to kind of play with these things as long as this is not how women should be required to look like off stage. You know, it's the only way you can ethically consume these types of performances is if outside of the performance space you constantly and aggressively dismantle these standards as requirements in a non-performance space. Because an office is not a theater, a sidewalk is not a stage, and if she is not getting explicitly paid to adhere to these standards, then it is categorically unethical to ask women to adhere to them.
Got it.
And on the pay part, I wanted to give a little financial breakdown on what it costs to maintain all of these things. And so I have, my text is covering up some of these things. So I'm gonna, the photo description, it's a photo shoot I did. I'm in the hallway of a dive bar covered with stickers. My hands are braced against the wall. My legs are as smooth and as airbrushed as they can get. My stomach is exposed. I'm wearing tiny little shorts, a crop top, and I have makeup, spray tan, lashes, nails, the whole works. So here's and then I'm gonna read out the text for anyone listening in. Nails, about $100 a month. I do spend about $100 a month on these nails when I have the money to. $100 a month on these nails. Lashes are about $30 a month. I do strip lashes, but a lot of female performers get lash extensions, which is way more than $30 a month. Yeah. My spray tan membership, when I had one, was over $50 a month. My waxing, all of these, just so you know, this is pre-pandemic life for me. I don't do a lot of these things now because I'm just not in that performance space right now. I'm just working in my studio. But in the peak of my performance days, this was what I was doing. Waxing for pits and bikini is at least $80 a month. Teeth whitening averaged about to be $20 a month. Makeup averaged $50 a month. Gym membership averages $50 a month. Clothing, I'm a thrift store queen, so I don't spend a lot of clothing. But for other performers, it's at least $50 a month. I guess that was how much I spent on fishnets anyway. Hair, at minimum, if I was maintaining this Platinum Pixie by myself, which I do a lot of hair shows, so I don't have to pay for it, but maintaining the Platinum Pixie by myself is at minimum $100 a month, if not much more. It's an incredibly expensive haircut to maintain. Skincare is at least $50 a month. This is a monthly total of well over $500, depending on, you know, some things I'll spend more on, some things I'll spend less on, to have this appearance. So asking any woman to have any of these things without paying her to do this is unethical and objectifying, because you're asking her to perform for you.
Yep. This is a car payment. That I had no idea how much this was.
Now, like some people get you, like Some people go and get a $30 manicure. I don't, because $30 manicures typically support trafficking situations. Like manicures are, I get acrylic nails. They need to be at least like $80 if you're getting a service done. That's just a PSA for anyone out there. Like if you're paying $20 to get acrylic nails, you're supporting like a trafficking front. That's not how much those nail techs deserve to get paid for their time.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just a little side note. So yeah, it costs a lot of money for the hot girl disguise, and it's not effortless. I choose to do this, but I was also getting financially compensated to do this.
Right.
Now it's fine. If you want to do these things, men or women or non-binary people, if you want to do all of these things, the point is that's fine. What's not fine is expecting these as a standard for your body in a non-performance space.
Right. You
know, even in a performance space, like obviously if I go to a burlesque theater and somebody's up there with body hair, I'm not gonna be like, well, I'm paying her to not have body hair. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just, this is the point I'm saying with people not being able to recognize a performance space, because all of these things are part of this play. It's part of this fantasy of this object of desire that I consent to do within that space. Let's see my next slide. Because prettiness is not the rent you pay to occupy a space marked female. And this is a quote by Aaron McKean. It's one of my favorite quotes.
That is so good.
Mm-hmm. This does kind of, this does kind of wrap it up for me then, or not like the, you know, obviously you have more to talk about, but I or anybody shouldn't expect a woman to walk into work looking like $1 million because she's not necessarily getting paid to do that.
Uh-huh. Okay. And the, you know, the takeaway, do I have a takeaway thing? Okay, here's a funny meme. So guys, sexualize women. Women makes a profit off the sexualization. Guys, wait, no, I hate hoes. So the takeaway is you also can't demand women adhere to this standard and then demonize us if we choose to make a living off of adhering to this standard.
Yep.
Like I, to promote a safe and healthy society for women, people, men especially, need to recognize performative female sexualization and women simply existing. Because if we raise men to feel entitled to women's bodies and that they are owed a hot girl, which is a trope that you see in a lot of media, and that sexy women are not in fact independent human beings with our own agency, they can't differentiate between performance and life. And to bring up like a cringy trope, it's kind of like when dudes go to the strip club and then they think that the stripper actually likes them. Because
are you telling me they don't?
Honey, she's doing a job. You're paying for a service, like, and you, but not being able to tell the difference, being like, oh, performance and life, like, bro, she actually likes me. It's like, honey, sweetheart, no, bless your heart, no. Just give her money and leave. That's the takeaway. And here's my glow up. I'm drinking pickle juice out of that picture, by the way, of me in the sippy cup. The takeaway is what can be objectifying to some can be empowering to others, and vice versa. And to tell the difference, it's you kind of need to know more about the woman in question and the parameters in question. A lot of people, when I'm on stage, there was kind of this, yeah, but don't you hate it that like guys are looking at you and like being gross? Like, first of all, that happens all day, every day when I walk out of the house, regardless of how much effort I put into my appearance. When I'm on, I found a liberation on stage of being able to embrace this kind of performative sexual part of myself in a safe place, because the safest I am is when I'm on stage. The security system there is great. In casinos, we don't have a customer's always right policy. If anybody is weird in any way, they get kicked out of the nightlife venue. They've got pretty strict like standards of behavior. And I found empowerment on stage. Choosing the sexualized female performance for myself was liberating. It was especially liberating after purity culture and religion. But some people might find after they pursue this career that they don't like it and they feel objectified and they feel like they aren't recognized as a person, it is kind of up to the individual. And there's not a be-all catch-all on this is the one way and this is not the way. So I just hope that this was able to give some of y'all some information. I hope my talk didn't go too long. I know I've been rambling for a long time. I don't know if there are any questions. I'm happy to answer them.
But Glenda, I've just found the whole talk fascinating. It's introduced thoughts to me that I had not understood before. I love those questions on who has the power, who controls the space, who has the choice, what is the impact. I took a photo of it because I think that that's really important to remember. I actually think they are really good questions for a lot of settings.
Right.
It just really has come together very nicely. I loved your talk. Loved it.
Right. And I'm consenting to being there. Like, I choose, I'm not forced into this career. I consent to being on stage and being an object of desire on stage. I like not wearing a lot of clothes. I like it. I love the whole aesthetic. I love being in crop tops and thongs. It's my favorite. I love it. But that's for me. Yes. It's not for other people. And that's like, it's almost like women are individual human beings with our own individual desires and parameters for what we want for our life. Hi. I think I have one more picture. I do have, oh, there we go. There's my bonus picture of my purity culture already being groomed into like Bible drill days. I was actually in a Bible drill competition. I'm sure I had to memorize the one of women submit to your husbands. So I'm gonna, I guess I can stop screen share because I think I'm not gonna find the button. I guess I've got to exit first.
Oh, I can do it.
But that really goes full circle, I think. The whole purity culture, all of the, what you just said about, you know, the headship arrangement and women being submissive and all of that stuff. It all contributes to the view that people have in society about women's bodies. Mm-hmm. It's just that when you boil it all down, it tends to come from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on like it's very, very bad that you are triggering desire in other people, because I have been taught that women doing that is immoral and wrong. And I personally enjoy that sensation when I'm consenting to doing that job. Right. So that's, you know, I don't like it when I'm not on stage.
Yes, exactly. Consider the space. Yeah.
Right. Like I'm not, she's got some problematic things, but there's a Pink song. It's like, I'm not here for your entertainment. And it's talking about just existing out in a bar. It's like, I'm not here to perform for you. Get the fuck out of my face. And that's how I feel now when I'm not on stage. It's like, get, go away from me. Don't look at me. Like, I'm not here for you. Yeah.
I'm sure there are questions I have been completely ignoring. What's happened to them?
I haven't had the chat on at all. So you're going to have to ask questions.
But I kind of want to know, where do you feel as a performer and as a woman and as an intersectional feminist, mm-hmm. where do you feel that society is sort of lending to? Do you think there's going to be attitudes changing, or do you think we are still stuck in these roles and in this pattern of objectifying female bodies? Do you see it improving at all? What hope is there?
Right. I love that question. It's a great question. It's also, it's a complicated answer. Sometimes I think it feels like we take two steps forward and one step back. There has been, you notice that I brought up Victoria's Secret as an example of a couple of those slides with Victoria's Secret images. If for those who either don't shop at Victoria's Secret, don't know anything about them, whatever, Victoria's Secret for decades was kind of the end all. It was like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit model edition. It was what we saw as this is what is sexy and it's hot. And this is the Angel fashion show and whatever. Another performer note, I've actually worn a couple of the wings that were worn in the show because one of my friends makes those wings. I think they're very cool, but that's just my own little toot my own horn side note. But if you aren't aware, if you go to Victoria's Secret today, their marketing campaign has turned around so fast that I've got whiplash. If you go into Target, there has been a revolution in the past 2 years, 3 years. This has been very recent, of advertising finally kind of catching up with contemporary progressive attitudes towards bodies and towards women, and showing bodies, not photoshopping out cellulite, not photoshopping out scars, keeping body hair. I work for one of the companies I model for is Pop Fit activewear, as well as Cheek Boss underwear, and they totally include extra, extra, extra large models. They include women who are disabled. They include women who, one that has like a colostomy bag, body hair, scars, acne. When I did a photo shoot with them, I remember having the experience, I did a underwear shoot with them, and I knew when I was posing on set, like, they are not gonna, I have a scar on my hip, they are not gonna Photoshop out this scar, and I'm feeling self-conscious about it. Because every other professional photo shoot I've done is always like airbrush, blah, yeah, this. And so I feel like some ways we are making progress. We also, the rise of raunch culture, and not to get into deeper intellectual feminist theory, but so the rise of raunch culture was something that happened. We came from purity culture, purity culture, purity culture. And then we had the ability to have the internet and porn for everybody. And so you saw that with like, Girls Gone Wild became a thing in like the late 90s. Do you have Girls Gone Wild in Australia?
It's Sheila's Gone Wild.
Okay, it's porn. It's like they go to a party scene somewhere in spring break, and they get clearly underage, sometimes barely 21, sometimes 18-year-old women drunk, and then have them take off their tops and like, it's my first time. And it's like, the manipulation here is maybe not the greatest thing ever. And there's, you know, there's, if you do research into it, it's a really gross company. But the raunch culture that happened with the sexualization of women for the male gaze, that was, had this like shell on the front put of it as, this is sex positivity and this is empowering. I think about that with like Playboy. So Hugh Hefner died, thank God, like last year or something. And after he died, there was a lot of discussion about like, Hugh Hefner did more for female sexuality than, because he let women be sexual. It's like, there is a difference between female sexuality and female sexualization for male consumption. Okay? Like, the Playboy model is not what is, capital IS, female sexuality. It's for male consumption. And it's not that the consumption part is bad. It's not that having big, huge fake tits and hairless body and whatever is bad. It's just important to recognize that that's not like sex positivity for women, right? It's a fantasy for consumption. And also, Hugh Hefner was a fucking monster. I hate his guts. He's glad he's dead. No, he really, if we talk about who is the power and who is the control and what is the impact, those models were treated horrendously. The Playboy Mansion was a clusterfuck shitshow. There are a lot of women who I know in Vegas who were playmates and work with, and I've, like Holly Madison does a lot of shoots in Vegas, and I'm not trying to sound like a douchebag with all my connections to these famous people, but she's written a lot about her experiences and what it was like to be a Playboy bunny, and it is harrowing. Right. So, right, like, once again, it takes diving a little deeper, getting to know. I'm trying to come back to your question. Are we?
Well,
like I said, two steps forward, one step back.
Right. Okay. Well, and I suppose that's kind of evolution, really, isn't it?
We are getting, you know what, I am seeing refreshing things. Like, I see stuff that like, wow, that's really surprising. Like, I feel like there has been a revolution of true female sexual pleasure in the past couple of years. First of all, speaking of Playboy, Playboy didn't even recognize that the female orgasm existed as a thing until like the 90s. They literally said it wasn't, it's like, there's no way. Y'all are lying. It's not true. You don't come like that. Like, clitoral orgasms weren't a thing. That kind of bullshit. And it's, we've seen this, there's kind of has been this sexual revolution with the advent of the internet and sex positive feminist awareness of true, I don't know, I feel like we have seen some strides with queer culture, with sex culture, like of progress that we're making. There's also still just such a massive amount of misogyny. I mean, like Louis C.K. just won an award, like people complaining about him being canceled after his sexual misconduct. He just won a fucking Grammy, right? So it's like, show me where he's canceled. Show where. I can't see it. Can you see it? I can't see it. You know, it takes, with all these famous people, it takes victims in the double digits to even make a dent. So
what would you like to see happen? What do you think are the next steps then? Or what would you hope to see happen to make progress?
Well, I think with the American education system, we seem to be going way backwards. And I think that like the Don't Say Gay bill and this kind of repressiveness, I think that if we having body positivity starting from youth, it is really fucked up now that this current generation with the whole performative thing and performance, I was born in 89. And so YouTube was only a thing when I was just about to graduate high school. And the generation now of especially young girls, the performance that they were constantly having to do on social media of editing their bodies, photoshopping everything, like face tuning, body tuning, everything, and constantly being in this performative, I'm presenting myself to you, I'm performing, here I am, like look at me, get my likes, get my follows, and not their fault. It's not their fault. It's just kind of this like perfect storm of if we continue to value these idea, you know, this, if we continue to see these fantasy factors for women as just normal, like normal female bodies, I think we're still going to struggle with people seeing that as like, just like, oh yeah, that's just how women look. Like, I don't know. It's complicated. It's complicated. I wish I had better answers. I am not, it's what I said. I'm not the feminist who's speaking for all of feminism. This is just my tiny little niche microcosm of what I know and what I can speak about.
But it helps to have these conversations, right? Because if we don't at least start to have the conversations and understand the nuance,
yes,
we can't hope for change. We can't hope that things will change.
Which is why I start with the body hair, because it is the easiest thing. It is a building block foundation for the concept of feminism. Start with that. If you see a woman with big hairy pits or hairy legs and you have this reaction, work on that. It's okay if you, it's okay to have, it took so long for me to deconstruct having a reaction of like, oh wow. Like it takes a long time. And the more you just got to work on like, when you have that thought of recognizing, okay, where is this coming from? What is this thought coming from? And that goes not just not just body hair on women. Like if you see men, masculine presenting people wearing feminine clothes or dresses to like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, to kind of normalize it for yourself. You start with yourself. Also, when you have the spoons, and that's a feminist term, when you have the energy and when you have the ability, call out your motherfucking friends if they're making some shitty comment. If you're with somebody and so like, ew, like, and they just want to say ew about body hair, I'm asking you, I know it can cause a lot of anxiety for people. It's a big deal to confront your friends. It's hard. I'm asking you to try to just start there, plant that little seed of doubt, plant a little of like, maybe it's okay. Maybe it's fine. You know, it's complicated.
Glenda, that was actually one of the questions that was asked is like, how can we impact, like, you know, especially me, this white straight guy, how can we impact the world, our own sphere of influence? Would you be okay if I, like, if we walked through it, like, with what you had just said, a reaction to a woman with hairy,
are we gonna Anthony Magnabosco this? Yes, we're gonna straight up epistemology this bitch. Okay, Okay, so
yes. like me, I'm the person. Okay. I see a woman like, oh my gosh, you see that hair under her armpits? Whoa, that is blah. And then like, what should I do as a response? Or what could I do?
Why do you think that's gross?
Well, because it's just gross, doesn't that? I mean, the sweat, the hair. I mean, it's gross. Come on.
Is it gross? It's gross. Is it gross when men do it?
Well, no. I mean, they're not expected to shave, I guess. But, you know, woman with a hair under armpits, she's dirty. She probably stinks. Like, got to be a hippie.
So it's dirty. So by that logic, then men who have hairy armpits are dirty and gross. In fact, more so, I would think, with hormones and testosterone and sweat glands. So it's dirty and gross when men do it. So men should shave. I'm in agreement with that. Men should totally shave.
Don't you dare flip the tables on me. Man, you kind of did. Oh, I felt weird getting pinned into the corner right there.
Right. One of my dancer friends, one of my first jobs in Vegas, I was like cocktail waitressing in this theater, and one of my co-waitresses was Mormon. I don't know how
Mormon than woman?
But Mormon. She was a Mormon. And I don't know how it worked out on being a cocktail waitress in Sin City as a Mormon. I don't know. Don't ask me. I can't. But she was. I remember she mentioned like, oh, it's about to be pool season and like, oh, it's so gross with like Europeans and they have their hairy armpits. And I probably could have been a little nicer, but I went through it. I was like, why is it gross? Why? Well, and then you back someone into this corner. In this case, I almost quite literally had backed her into a corner. So I feel bad about that. I'm sorry. Your body language is important. But you find that people, you know, they backpedal and they backpedal, and then they get to their pitiful excuses left in their hands. Like, what? Oh, well, it was just how I was raised. It's like, well, that's not an excuse. I was raised in a really racist area. That doesn't give me an excuse to be racist. It's like, I've got to work on that. And she also, I think using somebody's, if you know someone's logic parameters of using that with them, because she was Mormon, I was of course an atheist at the time and still am, but I asked like, okay, let me ask, like, you believe in God and you believe that God has created women in like this perfect image. So why do you believe that then you have to alter that? Isn't that kind of you disagreeing with God's creation?
Good question.
Because I knew I wasn't going to turn her into an atheist right there. Like that wasn't my goal. That my goal was to not remove her faith. My goal was to get her to rethink about
and God. Work within the parameters that she.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the common ground. That's that if you know somebody's common ground or like, I know this about you. And by using this logic with you, maybe I can walk you through with your own ideas of what you think.
Yeah.
And then it's exhausting, but trying to remain open and not judgmental and try to do your best to not trigger a defense response and an anger response. We've had him on RFRX before. I cannot recommend him enough. Anthony Magnabosco with Street Epistemology. Please, please, please go watch some of his videos. It will change your life. You will learn how to talk to people in a way that you have never thought you could talk to people.
Yeah.
It's life-changing. It truly is. And for arguments about feminism, it can be very empowering to have those tools in your like mental toolbox of how to talk to people about these issues.
Mm-hmm. I think we have time for one more question. Is that all right, Sherry?
Oh,
yeah. Yes. Oh, do I get to pick between? Time for one more. I think, Glenda, what is your view on legalizing sex work?
Oh, yes. I'm so glad somebody asked this fucking question. The idea, let me present this to you. It is perfectly legal and acceptable for us to pay people to have sex as long as we get to watch it. But it's not legal to pay someone to have sex. And that's the difference between porn. And so go-go dancing is considered adjacent to the sex work industry, and I have plenty of personal friends who work as professional escorts and sex workers. Some are porn stars and some are escorts. Sex work, absolutely. The idea that it is not legalized baffles my mind. If you legalize sex work, you were then able, I promise it seems a little counterintuitive. It's like, if you decriminalize drug use, you're going to help addicts. But it truly does. If you legalize sex work, you will be able to protect sex workers so much more, because criminalizing sex work and punishing the people who are participating in sex work. Now, remember how I talked about choosing to remove your body here in a society where it's so forbidden is not exactly a free choice. Under capitalism, and with the economics of our nation the way it is and all over the world, sex work, it can be complicated, because it's not exactly a free choice to become a sex worker if you have no other financial options available to you.
Right.
So in order for that to be a free decision, we at the same time have to work on equalizing our economy so that it is not something that would force somebody into that position.
Right.
Like, I can choose, to do other professions. I'm not financially obligated to choose a profession where I use my body, because I don't I'm not forced to choose go-go dancing over another type of job. I have the freedom to choose. If somebody doesn't have the choice, the only way I'm going to feed my family because of my education, because of where I am, because of all these things, is to do sex work, then that's not a free choice. So the only way it can be ethical for us to decriminalize sex work, legalize sex work, is if we also work on those other things. You can't do one and then not the other.
Right.
So yeah. Sex work also, if you talk to sex workers, I highly recommend following the Insufferably Intolerant Science Nerd on Facebook. They used to be a professional escort and sex worker. They're also getting their PhD in something. Can't remember what it is, but they write a lot about science, but they've written about their experiences. And I'm pretty sure she uses she, her pronouns, but I'm not quite certain, so I'm going to keep with they. They've written about their experiences as a sex worker. And if you talk to sex workers, you find that sexuality is an important, Daryl could talk about this. It's such an important part of humanity. It's so important. And some people, especially the lonely American male, and the fact that we so demonize men for seeking out friendships and companionships, and we deny them touch so much, that for so many, sex work allows them to have intimacy with somebody that is important. And so I believe in the good that sex work can do. I also believe in the fucked up bad that sex work can do. You know, it's that goes to me, that's the criminalization of it, though, because with the criminalization comes the pimps, it comes the cop stings, and it's we have to start. There's so much to do. There are some, what's the name of it? There's a great org to check out that is all about decriminalizing sex work. The red umbrella is the symbol for that platform, because when we talk about the umbrella of sex work, on all the things that fall underneath it, stripping, escort, camp girls, pornography, and go-go dancing is adjacent. I dance in a thong and bra and have people put money in my thigh highs. It can be seen as a type of sex work. We should have a sex worker on. We should talk to a professional sex worker about it, I would think. But there's such a range.
That's actually a really great idea.
I would love to have that. We were close with Aaron Lewis, but didn't quite get there. But
right. And there is a big difference between stripping and actual full escort service. There is a big difference. And there's a big difference in some escorts use an agency. They have a professional agency that they're contracted out through, and it's all just done discreetly and whatever. There's also, I live close, not too far away from brothels. So we have legalized brothels in outside Las Vegas, not in Las Vegas, but outside. So you can go to the brothel and pay and have sex with somebody, and it's perfectly legal. I'm not comparing sex work to abortion, but just like abortion and drugs, legalizing it or not legalizing it, it doesn't keep people from doing it.
No, so exactly.
Having sex work not be legal has not kept sex work. The whole joke about it's the world's oldest profession, people will do it. I have sex worker friends in my life who love it, who genuinely, I chose to be a sex worker. I love getting paid to have sex with people. I have and they're close friends of mine, and I respect their opinion. I also know people whose lives were totally destroyed by it.
Yeah.
As with the other thing, it depends. It's more
content. It's nuanced, and legalizing it, I imagine, would bring in regulations to protect the sex worker. But and
I'm a big fan of regulations. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
To protect consent, to explain mm-hmm. what consent is and when it is there and when it is not there. There's all so many things involved in that. But if we just stick our heads in the sand and don't ask these difficult questions or start to, like, legalizing it, I think, would force those conversations to have to happen to then put some frameworks in place to protect everybody. And I agree with you completely. You've then got to look at, I suppose, when you turn the tap on, who is coming into that industry? Are they in a safe place? Are they being manipulated to be in that position?
Right. Or
disadvantaged in somehow?
Right.
And are there opportunities then for the government to provide assistance so that that person isn't in a disadvantage? I mean, I'm speaking utopian.
In a utopian Star Trek society, right.
Yeah. Like,
everyone gets coupons for, you get your free sex work visit at the brothel, and it's all hunky-dory and it's great, and the sex robots overrule us with our abortion stores and weed shops every single corner, and it's the best thing ever. There are some areas of the world where there is regulation, where they have legal brothels, and there's regulations like, right, you got to make sure that these safety parameters are met, that you're testing your clients, sex workers are tested and everything is like safe and protected and all those things. Those are great ideas. You know, but the porn comparison it's perfectly fine that we can pay people to have sex all damn day as long as we get to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glenda.
Yes.
Thank you so, so much for coming on and having this conversation with us. I really, really loved it. Before we kind of wrap up conclude, do you have any final thoughts or final words that you'd want to leave us with?
I guess, please, please, please feel free to go to your local burlesque theater. Go to your, if you know, like, if we're in a nightclub, I don't recommend you necessarily go into a nightclub because they're not necessarily easy or cheap to get into, depending on where you are. But feel free to financially support them and enjoy it. Enjoy it for the fantasy and play that it is. And I encourage you, when you're seeing any performer, but especially female performers, like, recognize, she's really fun and this is sexy and pretty. But like, at the end of the day, like, she's going home to her own life and her own world. And she has an entire history and desires and dreams and goals and sadnesses and traumas and like every other person. And just rethinking of like, oh, this is demeaning towards women, or this is empowering towards women. It's like, it could be, it might be. But maybe we have to ask some more questions first to find that out.
Excellent. Thank you. Hey. Thank you again.
Yeah. I'm really excited to be here.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.